even eisegetically, you know, these opening, the infancy narratives in Luke are great. I mean, you could do a whole seminar on these on these chapters, if nothing else, to deal with the eisegetical questions of how they relate to the rest of the gospel, where Luke got this information. I mean, all those sort of historical questions that are fascinating. Also from the point of view that it's always seemed to me that this is some of the most Hebrew New Testament Greek you have, and for good reason, because they were probably speaking Hebrew or Aramaic to one another, and the Magnificat is in fact a nice piece of Hebrew poetry. It just has been translated into Greek. And I'm sure, I don't know if there's actually a study of this, you know, Jeremias always tried to retranslate everything. But it would be a neat exercise to try to retranslate this back into Hebrew and then analyze it. I mean, you're dealing in speculation there in terms of the text, but it's just some fun stuff. The other issue that comes up here is this whole role of women. And it's fascinating, and I think these are some very positive things that ought to be said in the church, especially you have to be a little careful that people don't overreact to these sorts of things on either side of, quote, the women's issues. But it certainly is true that women play a very integral part in the life of the salvation history here, both at the beginning of the gospel. And here you've got these two women very much not just as those who bear the children that are significant, but who are making these astounding theological commentary on everything. And, of course, it's women at the end of the gospel who are the first witnesses to the resurrection. And we can't forget this. I don't know, anybody who's observed the church would certainly, I think, come to the conclusion empirically that women are probably more the backbone of religious life in society than men are. It's the women in most families that see to it that the kids get to Sunday school, and they'll be the ones that drag everybody out of bed on Sunday morning, and dad, well, you know, he'll read the paper. And we can't forget this somehow. I'm not making a speech just on that theme. But I think that's also the connection to Micah. Why this text in Micah? If anything, the Bethlehem Ephrathah text, you'd think would be paired with the business in Matthew where this is quoted. All right? And if for no other reason, it's a reminder that there's more to this Micah text than just, golly gee, Micah got it right. He said the magic place name, Bethlehem. Now, I don't mean to demean that insight whatsoever, because that's exactly Matthew's point, that the prophets actually called some of these shots right on the button, and even the Jewish leaders in the first century recognized this, all right? They bring this the scroll of Micah out to say, I think it was Bethlehem. And that's precisely the point. But I think in your preaching and in your understanding of this text, there is more to this than just saying, wow, isn't it neat how God said it would happen in Bethlehem, and it happened in Bethlehem. Micah 5 is part of a piece that I believe, it's very difficult to outline these prophets, starts with verse 8 of the previous chapter, where you have the personal pronoun atah. And as for you, Migdal Eved, a tower of the, or fortress of the Eder, of the sheep, or something like that. Well, I can't go through all of this, but you ought to read, even in English, these preliminary verses, if nothing else, because this is talking all about how the people are going to be destroyed. And what's really striking here is the reference to Babylon in verse 10. I mean, there's two issues here. One is the birth of a child. The other is the imminent destruction of God's people. You have, for example, the expression at the end of verse 9 about the one who is writhe like a woman giving birth. Ka yoleda, like a yoleda. You see the verbal root yalad there, like a bearing one. Then verse 10 says something like writhe and squirm in pain. This is describing childbirth. Bath-Zion, O daughter Zion, like a yoleda participle, like a giving birth one. Ki ata, for now you will go from the city, and you will dwell in the field, and you will come unto Babylon. There you will be rescued. Now, this is an astounding statement in Micah's day, and of course, everybody believes that this is a later edition. I shouldn't say everybody. Every historic critical worth his weight in historical criticism says it's a later edition. That you have here in the 8th century someone talking about Babylon. But the other point I'm making is that the person is talking about someone who's about to give birth. Now, you'll notice that the chapter is organized with this. It starts with atah in verse 8, the personal pronoun you. Then you've got these other atahs at verse 9. We saw one in verse 10b. We saw one in verse, you can see one in verse 11. BHS has set up the text real nice for you here. And you see one in verse 14. But this is the other atah, which doesn't mean the personal pronoun you, but is the adverb now. And I think he's just kind of playing with this concept between the you that seems rather imminent, but not yet, giving birth but not yet born, and the atah, which is very imminent and now in the immediate context. Verse 14 ends this chapter. And now you will gadaz, whatever gadaz means, I'm not sure anybody really knows, something about being attacked. Bath gadod, or bath gadud, that's a pun, daughter of being attacked, or whatever this means. Clearly a reference to Zion again. Remember the bath is Zion earlier. They will build up a fortress against you. The last line is important. With a shavit, with a rod, they will naka, they will strike upon the cheek. A chelech is a cheek of your face, not the other part of your body. They will strike upon my cheek. They will strike upon the cheek, the shofet Yisrael, the shofet, the judge of Israel. Note the pun here between the shavet, the rod, and the shofet, the judge of Israel. So this is describing the ruler of Israel as one who is being struck and hit by the enemies. Right, that's the context of this. Now, in almost striking contrast to that judgment motif, you have 5:1. Va'ata Beth Lechem Ephratah. Ata. Do you see that this ata picks up the ata of verse 8? All right, but you, and there he was being described as a fortress having to do with being a shepherd, watching over the sheep. But you, Beth Lechem Ephratah, now this Ephratah business is really just apparently distinguishing this Bethlehem from the other Bethlehem, which was up in the north somewhere, or two Bethlehems. So there you say Springfield, Missouri, as opposed to Springfield, Illinois. The you seems to be referring to the city or the village. You can hardly call this a village, city, or the village of Bethlehem. Sa'ir, little, least, insignificant. All right, this is not, we were doing adjectives, and this is not so much size, but significance. Little, lehyoth, to be, infinitive of haya, in the alfei Yehuda. Elef means either thousand or clan. And the jury's perpetually out on this one. All right. I think clans works better. You're talking about family groups here, but you could translate thousands. Now, this is, we're just talking about adjectives. Little to be means too little to be. This is almost a use of the superlative, or the least to be in the clans of Judah. Now, the point is self-evident and one that you obviously know. I mean, this is not unlike the first shall be last and last shall be first. It's from the most insignificant little town, not, I don't think this is only Bethlehem, but also not Jerusalem. Get it? which is turns out to be kind of a slap in the face to the institutionalized bureaucratic church in Jerusalem who think they know theology, when in fact this little rabbi guy from Nazareth, oh, but it turns out he wasn't born in Nazareth, shows him up. Mimica from you, Li, to me, Yetse, look, even the first-year Hebrew students here can do all these words. Yetse will go out, he will go out. Who's the subject of Yetse? Unstated. It's kind of vague. And that's, in a sense, troubling, but maybe intentional. The subject is really not stated. From you to me will go out to be lehiyos a moshel, a mashaling, a ruling one, participle, be Israel, in Israel. Interesting that the word king is not used here, too. Sometimes I think that the word king is intentionally avoided when we're talking about the messianic king, lest there be a misunderstanding of what a king is supposed to do. Motzaothau, his motzaoth. You can see the verb yatsa here. It's a noun that means going out, probably literally from the womb, in the sense of coming forth from the womb, and therefore means something like origin. His origins are Mekedem, from of old. Now here I'm a little bit cautious to overinterpret it. Mekedem really means just from a long time ago, probably within history, though one would like, knowing Christology the way we do now, to read here sort of even from before creation, all right? But I'm not sure that you can read all of that in here. All the Hebrew is saying is from a long time ago, and I think the point is simply that God has been working this in history from a long time ago. And that's paralleled by mime olam. Mi yame, construct of yom, yamim, yame, from days of olam, a long time. Here, going past, we often use olam future. Here, it's clearly past. Therefore, well, on what does this therefore follow? Therefore, well, I guess upon the fact that there's still a ruler coming forth from Bethlehem. Now, put yourself in the 8th century, brethren. All right, don't just read this as an Advent text for the 20th century, or as a prophecy fulfilled in the first century. What about the people in Micah's day? Okay, they don't know whether they should put all their trust in these Davidic kings they got or not. And in Micah's day, some were good and some were not good. Hezekiah, very good. Is this the guy? And if nothing else, this prophecy is saying to the people in that day, there's a bigger picture here, folks. There's something more than just putting all your eggs in the near-term future and hoping Hezekiah will take care of the Assyrians and then we can all celebrate utopia or something like that. In fact, now we move our focus not from the present until the future. Therefore, yit to name, he will give them, direct object put on the verb, az eith, up to a time of the yoleda yalada, or yoleda yalada. Great stuff here. Until the participial person about to bear one, note it's feminine, yalada, perfect, third feminine singular, has born. Until the bearing one has given birth. Who's the bearing one? I mean, it's real easy to say, oh, Mary. And that's true. I'm not disputing that. But again, put yourself in Micah's day, and there, I think they're asking the same question. Who are you talking about? Who is this one? And Micah almost intentionally doesn't answer the question. He says, figure it out. Wait and see. And the yether of his achau, ooh, and the remnant of his achs, note that's a ending that goes on a plural noun. And the remnant of his brethren or brothers. Now, what's this talking about? Who's the he of his brothers? What's the antecedent? Probably this guy who is going to come forth to be ruler in Israel. Who's the remnant then of his brothers? Well, first ask, who are his brothers? Well, those must be the sons of Israel. And the remnant of his brothers must be the sons of Israel who are now on the other side of some kind of destruction from which they have been preserved as a remnant. All right, you can't have a remnant until you have something from which to be saved. And the remnant of his brothers will yashuvun, you got that energic nun there, will return al b'nei Yisrael. How do you translate al? Now you learn that this means upon, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense here, and there's an interesting footnote with no textual evidence whatsoever that you should understand al as el. That they will return to the B'nai Yisrael. Well, obviously that makes a lot of sense, all right? And there are times when El and Al seem to be interchanged. But golly, I'm never that comfortable with just solving the problem by the easier reading. I think Al, this is plugged into a whole motif, you see, that in the restoration, the sons of Israel will literally bear people upon them. Now, bear the next generation. Carry them, and then Al works much better. You can almost see people carrying their children, which is driving this always into the future, into the next generation, upon the sons of Israel. And Amad, he will stand. I think you got to read this as perfect, wow, consecutive future. Now, who's the subject of Amad? Israel? Must be he, this same Moshe El Yisrael that we talked about in verse 1. He will stand and ra'ah, and shepherd, act as shepherd. It's a verb to be a shepherd. Ba'oz Yahweh, in the oz of Yahweh, strength of Yahweh. In the ga'on, in the majesty of the Shem Yahweh Elohau, in the majesty of the name of the God, sorry, in the name of Yahweh, his God. Nice construct chain there. And now we've picked up this shepherding image with which we started in 4 verse 8. I think this is the end of the section. And yashavu, now the verb goes plural, they will yashav. Who's they? Must be the people, Israel. The remnant, it's sort of all of the above, if you will. The remnant, the sons of Israel, Israel. And they will yashav, they will live, reside. It doesn't say where, it doesn't say how, it just says they will live, they will reside, dwell. Why? Ki atah, one more atah, this is the seventh use of either atah now or atah you in this section. For now he will gadal, be great. Remember he was called, you were called the Migdal in verse 8 of chapter 4. It's great inclusio. For now he will be great unto the ends of the earth. Wow, we've just shifted our perspective from this little town of Bethlehem to the ends of the earth. That's the end of this pericope. Now, verse 4a usually gets included, which reads, and this one, Zay, we just had that word, huh? And this guy will be Shalom, which isn't a bad line to end with, except that I think 4a begins the rest, this is sort of the next paragraph, which runs through 5, and says the following things. Assyria is still in the game. This one will be peace, but as for Assyria, when they come into our land, and now they're going to conquer our land, but, it says, he will raise up against him 7 shepherds, 8 rulers of men. Who are these guys? We can't interpret all of this yet today. And they will shepherd the Eretz Ashur with a sword. Wow. And the land of Nimrod with something, daggers, they think. And now look at 5b. 5b, I think, is the verb that goes, that finishes 4a. This one will be peace. He will deliver from Assyria. So in a sense, the guy they're talking about is a guy who's going to deliver them from Assyria, which brings this whole pericope back to the immediate context of the 8th century BC, when the problem is Assyria. And I think in preaching on a text like this, that's also a reminder that you don't just make the point that prophecy is fulfilled in Christ, but that both prophecy and its fulfillment have an immediate relevancy for the situation, the historical situation in which God's people are struggling. In the 8th century, this is dealing with the problem of Assyria. In the 20th century, on the eve of the 21st century, it's the problem of any other contemporary enemy hostile to the kingdom of God, which may, in fact, be our own culture and state, rather than some far-off, anti-Christ in the Near East. But to make that sort of relevant connection to the contemporary scene. Well, golly, we better quit. But great, great stuff here. I mean, two rich passages.
Before you go, did anyone pick up a 26th edition of Nestle? My old 26th edition, I've misplaced that somewhere.
And it's